Okay, so our first speaker is Professor Deborah Bateson. Deborah is the Medical Director of Family Planning New South Wales and Clinical Associate Professor in Obs, Gynae and Neonatology at the University of Sydney. She's worked in the area of sexual health and reproductive health for over 18 years as a clinician, educator, researcher and is past chair of ASHA. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you to the organisers for inviting me to present on contraceptive choice and women living with HIV. So we know that there are high rates of unintended pregnancies documented in women living with HIV, particularly in adolescents, fertile adolescents and young women. In fact, we know from a Canadian study the rates of unintended pregnancy were around 61%, much higher than the national average, which was around about 30%. And in one US study, it was as high as 83%. So we know that the risk factors for unintended pregnancy and for HIV can be similar, such as substance abuse, mental health disorders, intimate partner violence. And, of course, unintended pregnancies increase the risk of perinatal HIV transmission and exposure to potentially teratogenic ARV. So pregnancy planning, preconception care and contraception absolutely need to be incorporated into routine HIV care. So what we want is women living with HIV, we need to be all aware that women who want to prevent pregnancy are potentially eligible for all methods of contraception, but some may be more appropriate than others. And what we're going to be considering is the factors that influence contraceptive choice in general, specific considerations for women living with HIV, and we want to look at how we can best support informed, informed decision-making. And I'll give you an overview of current and some future contraceptive options, and we're going to be ensuring that we've got an evidence-driven, rights-based approach. So what's in our toolkit in 2019? We generally classify contraception by how often the woman or her partner or the couple has to do something to make it effective. So on the left-hand side there, you've got the permanent method, so tubal sterilisation, the SNP or vasectomy. We've got the LARC methods. That's a term you're probably familiar with, long-acting reversible contraceptives. That's the implants, one rod in Australia, two rod implant in New Zealand, the hormonal and copper IUDs. Then we've got the pills, the vaginal ring that's changed once a month, every month. Injections, and then the external and internal condoms, the diaphragm, and then we've got the fertility awareness methods. And just because they come in an app, the journalists are very keen on this at the moment, doesn't make them any more effective, I have to say. We've got the withdrawal method, and we shouldn't forget postcoital emergency contraception, very important. So this is just, I just want to point you in this direction of this excellent resource. It's on all the family planning organisational websites, and it's just really handy to have in your drawer to show to the woman, because it really shows that sort of efficacy, particularly of the long-acting methods, the LARC, IUDs and implants, which are as effective, and in fact the implant has superior efficacy to permanent methods. And the pill, of course, commonly used here and in New Zealand, we know that it can be, if it's used perfectly, it can be 99.5% effective, but we know that typical use is it's around about 93%, and that means 7 women in 100 in a year will fall pregnant. So just be aware of this resource. So there's lots of different factors that influence contraceptive choice. So there are things like medical eligibility. So has she got migraine with aura, for instance, which will preclude an estrogen-containing method? What about non-contraceptive benefits that the woman wants for her heavy menstrual bleeding, for instance, or acne? What about side effects, access, costs, effectiveness? And in this situation, effectiveness is important. But again, sometimes women will trade off effectiveness for other things. The best contraception, the most effective contraception, is one that women actually want to use and continue using. Discretion, we know that some women are at risk of reproductive coercion and need a discreet method that they can hide from their partner. Religious beliefs, future fertility plans, how often is someone having sex? And unfortunately, provider bias, we must ensure that we're always making sure that we're listening to what the woman wants and not giving her what we think is best for her. But it all comes down to personal preference in the end. But we do have some specific considerations as well. We need to check that the method we're giving is not having a negative effect on disease progression. And what's the effect on bone density? What about drug interactions, other chronic medical conditions, TB, for instance? And what about, you know, consideration of horizontal transmission? What's the partner's status? And is the woman on suppressive therapy? All of these have an impact. So let's have a think about drug interactions. We know that certain ARV may affect steroid hormone bioavailability, and this is mainly through the because they can induce liver enzymes, the cytochrome P450 system. What we do know is that it can actually work the other way around as well, so they're complex, these interactions, but we don't think there's any clinical significance of the effect of hormonal contraception on the bioavailability of ART medications. But I think what you need to do is just all be aware, and I'm sure you're all very aware of this Liverpool University tool, because it's very hard to keep up. We know that a lot of the studies are actually very poor quality of these interactions. They're often not looking at pregnancy outcomes, they're looking at pharmacokinetics, often very small numbers. But this is the way to do it, of course. So just to, you know, at a high level, the effective methods are combined and progestogen-only pills, the vaginal ring, the implants, and emergency contraceptive pills, where the ineffective hormonal methods are the depot injections, it's a whacking great dose of hormone, and the hormonal IUS or IUD, and that's because the hormone is acting locally in the uterus or the cervical mucus. So let's have a look at the different methods. So condoms have been central to the strategy, of course, for women with living with HIV. They obviously provide additional STI prevention benefits for those who need it. But there obviously is that concept of dual protection. And obviously WHO has been recommending consistent condom use alongside another effective method for women whose partner is negative, HIV negative, or if their status is unknown. But now there's an expanded definition, which is consistent condom use or a suppressed HIV viral load alongside an effective method can be considered as dual protection. But what we know is we just don't have any evidence. Canada's making a little bit of a start here. There's an excellent study have come out of there around contraceptive use under current ART recommendations for treatment and prevention. What we do need to remember is that condoms used on their own do not always have optimal effectiveness. So male condoms or external condoms have a failure rate up to 12%. It can be, you know, much less than that, but obviously we know that they can break, they can slip off, they can not be used. And the female condoms actually have a contraceptive failure rate up to 21%. And this is Robert Gorkin up there with his new hydrogel material, which is going to increase the acceptability of male condoms everywhere. And this is lovely Amanda. You can go on the website, the female condom website, and see her using a female condom. She's rather fabulous. This is the diaphragm. It doesn't really do anything, so all I'll say is it's not protective against STIs, and it doesn't prevent pregnancy very well either, but it is a barrier method, but only in name. So what about the permanent methods? No bias there. What about the permanent methods? So for people who have a woman that's decided that she wants no children or her family is complete, then obviously there is the possibility of permanent methods. So tubal sterilisation methods, just a reminder that, you know, it's a bigger deal than vasectomy. So it does need a general anaesthetic. It's usually done laparoscopically and it has to be seen as irreversible. It can be difficult for young women to access sterilisation. So when we're thinking about the rights-based approach, that's something to tackle. Vasectomy can be done in very low-tech settings. I work with Murray Stopes, so you do them on the back of a lorry, really. And just with a bit of local anaesthetic and a bag of frozen peas, you're fine. But, of course, it has to be considered irreversible. So that's why the world is waiting for this vasal gel. We've been waiting for about two decades now. Still only in monkeys, I'm afraid. So it is a potentially reversible vasectomy, which would be a great thing. So let's have a think about pills. We know they're commonly used, they're the most commonly used method amongst the general population in Australia, but they do have this up to 7% failure rate, and of course this may be greater with ARV because of that effect of the liver enzyme induction effect. And of course you've got the other possibilities of diarrhea and vomiting, reducing efficacy, but just to say there is no evidence for an effect on disease progression. A single RCT did show a risk of a declining CD4 count, but it wasn't shown in any other studies. But generally, you're going to check in the Liverpool website, and it may not be the ideal choice because just per se, they're not as effective as some of the long-acting reversible methods, of course. The rings are the same. So really, we have low ring use here. They're not subsidised on the PBS. They're combined. They've still got that potential for that drug interaction. We don't have any data in terms of HIV. So I think really it's similar. But I did want to just show this ring here. So this is a year-long vaginal ring, which was developed by the Population Council. It's actually potentially fabulous for low-income countries, very cheap option. And you can put all sorts of things in this ring, including antiretroviral medication. So we'll see a lot more of rings in the future. What about progestogen-only implants? So they are a set-and-forget lark. The ones here last for up to 3 years. The two-rod system in New Zealand lasts for 5. No impact on bone density, so that's a good thing. But there have been case reports of failure on ARV, so that has to be taken into consideration. But if a woman is choosing to use that, we don't want her to deny it and use nothing. So it's just thinking about that informed decision-making. Depots played an interesting role in the history of HIV, so there's no, it's been commonly used in many low-income countries, no interaction with ARV, it's private, it's convenient, it's discreet, no effect on disease progression, but it does, it is associated with a reduction in bone density. The association with fracture risk is unclear, but obviously for someone with HIV, they've got the impact of the disease itself and the impact of the medications on bone density, so that has to be taken into consideration. And it still needs 3 monthly visits. But you'll be interested to know that we've probably got a subcutaneous self-injectable depot coming our way next year in Australia, and this is what it looks like. It's got the same side effects, the same risks, so the bone density effect is considered the same, but it does give women autonomy, and it means that they can actually give it themselves. Of course, they can get a year's supply, particularly useful for rural areas. And I can't not mention this. I know it's a little bit off-piste because this is for women at risk of HIV, but this rocked the world, really. So this is the ECHO trial. There was lots and lots of observational studies showing that depo increased the risk of HIV acquisition. And depo, very cheap, is the main method of contraception used in high-prevalence countries, southern African countries. So they decided they needed to do an RCT, a very bold one, where they randomised women at risk of HIV to either depo, Jadel, a two-rod implant, or copper IUD to look at HIV acquisition rates. I stayed up till 1 o'clock in the morning and watched it come out in June, and there was no difference. So everyone breathed a sigh of relief, but there was some fallout from this. First of all, the HIV rates were very high all round in all groups. So condom use, you know, that seems... things are not going well there. And also the civil society group said, look, this is no excuse for these countries just to say, oh, let's just stick with depo and not bother bringing in these more expensive or more complicated LARC methods. So we just need to make sure we give good choices to everyone. So let's just come to IUDs, highly effective and cost-effective long-acting reversible method. The hormonal IUD up here lasts for 5 years. The copper IUDs last for 10 years. No drug interactions, no effect on bone density. They have a different effect on menstrual bleeding pattern, and that will influence an individual woman's choice. The Myrina, that's the trade name, reduces or abolishes bleeding altogether. Yep. And the copper IUDs actually create heavier or more prolonged bleeding. So that's something that has to go in the mix. Limited evidence shows no increased risk of post-insertion infection. We know there's an increased risk of infection in all women who have an IUD inserted in the first 3 weeks, but no difference in women with HIV. Remember that the copper IUD can be used as post-coital emergency contraception in the first 5 days after unprotected sex, very underutilised. We know from the guidelines that there's MEC is a medical eligibility criteria system. Basically, a MEC2 means good to go, all okay. If the CD4 count is 200 or above, absolutely no problems. And even if it's less than 200, it's still a MEC3. The advantages outweigh, the theoretical disadvantages outweigh the advantages. You have to weigh it up, but that may be, you know, a considered decision that is made. If HIV is diagnosed during use, the IUD can stay in place, and there's no evidence of an effect on disease progression, and no increased evidence of viral shedding or transmission either. There is a mini Myrina, we hope, a mini IUD coming our way. I think you've already got one in New Zealand, a 3-year one. This is a 5-year one called Kylena, dreadful name. We're probably not going to get the IUB, the intrauterine ball, which sits in the uterus. It's not very effective, but it's interesting. So just final thoughts. All methods are potentially suitable, and intrauterine contraception can be a useful choice. In a US nationally representative study, they found that there was low LARC use amongst women living with HIV. And we do know that across the board, there seems to be lower use of condoms with LARC, so something we need to think about than with shorter-acting methods. Emergency contraception is likely to be underutilised. For women on antiretrovirals, we advise liver enzyme-inducing ones. We advise a double dose of the levonorgestrel emergency contraception, or a copper IUD would be much better. Unintended pregnancies and contraceptive use remain understudied. I'd urge you all to study it. So really, access to reproductive health services is critical to ensuring reproductive needs are met and rights are protected. We need to preventing unintended pregnancies is an essential component of comprehensive vertical transmission prevention. And we need stronger linkages between sexual and reproductive health and HIV policies, programs and services. Thank you. Thank you.